Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Better Than Bad. This is season two, the last season of the show. We discussed a plethora of different actors and we even discussed one director. And now we are back for another season. And today I have a special guest joining me. I have Matt with me here today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I am fabulous. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks so much for bringing me on. And I did not know this was the season two now. This is exciting.
Yes, we are. I'm sort of took a little bit of a break and we're coming back into it. And we're kicking it off with a really interesting actor. Would you like to tell the people who we're discussing today?
We are talking about one Mr. Paul Franklin Dano. And it took me a long while to realize it is Dano, not Dano. In fact, there's many a season of my pod about this very actor where I'm calling him Dano. And right from the off, we kind of split it. It's me and my co-host, Daryl. The show is Paul Dano okay? And right from the off, there was never really any that we could find from our extensive research. Consensus of whether it was Dano or Dano. So he went with Dano, I went with Dano. That way one of us was right. Now I'm the one eating shit. I've got it wrong. Because with his expanded profile now in the wake of the Batman from earlier this year, there's been a lot more interview pieces with him. And so it's Dano.
I'm so glad that I got you to say his name. Because I was 100% going to say Dano.
I mean, I miss my Dano days. I was going to stick with it for a long while. But now I've managed to trick my brain into just sticking with Dano.
Dano. So yeah, Paul Dano, he is an American actor. He's probably best known for his roles in things like Prisoners, 12 Years a Slave, and most recently, as you just mentioned, The Batman. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about two of his films today. Obviously, the whole concept of this podcast, if you are only joining us in the second season, is that we take an actor's highest rated film on IMDb and their lowest rated film on IMDb, and then we compare and contrast. We have a little discussion and we find out whether we actually prefer the good one or the bad one, because sometimes my taste in films, it's not where it should be. So Paul Dano's highest rated film has actually recently changed.
Oh.
Yes. So on IMDb, when we originally decided that we were going to do this episode, his highest rated was There Will Be Blood, which has 8.2 stars. It has recently been beaten by The Fablemans with 8.3 stars.
Wow.
But I didn't have an invitation to TIFF, so I haven't seen that film. So
same.
We're still going to talk about There Will Be Blood. And then his lowest rated film, he actually has three films that all have the exact same rating. I chose the one that was the easiest to watch because all the other ones were very difficult to find.
Yeah, there's some weird ones down there.
So his three lowest rated films are The Newcomers, which I believe was his acting debut.
It is. That's one of the rare ones we've yet to cover. We're saving his first ever film for what will essentially be our last ever episode on his current output. So still to come.
His other one was Light and the Suffering.
Of course it is.
And then his other lowest rated film, which is what we will be discussing today, is called Weapons, and it has 4.8 stars on IMDb.
Available very handily on Freevee, right?
Exactly. You don't have to pay to watch this film, and spoiler alert, I wouldn't pay to watch this film.
You shouldn't.
So both these films actually came out in the same year. They both came out in 2007, and usually we go in chronological order on this podcast, and we talk about the one that came out first, but we have a rare moment where they came out in the same year. So I thought we'd actually discuss There Will Be Blood first, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So as I said, 8.2 stars on IMDb, a very high rating. It was released in 2007. It is written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, based on a book called Oil by a man whose name I've forgotten because I forgot to write it down.
Upton Sinclair.
There we go. The knowledge is coming in already. it stars Paul Dano, obviously, and Daniel Day-Lewis. I assume you'd seen this before because of your podcast, but had you seen it prior to doing your podcast? Was it something you were already aware of?
Yeah, so I did see this on release back in 2007, which is one of those years that's just heralded as one of the great sort of cinema years. You know, you've got 1982, you've got 1999, 2007's another one, because you've got this, you've got No Country for Old Men, you've got The Assassination of Jesse James, you've got Ratatouille, you know, all the classics, all the real high points of cinema. And I very much remember this as it came out. And I think I'd seen it maybe, I'd caught it a couple other times on DVD, and it was fast becoming sort of one of my favorites of these type of films, you know, the lengthy, slow sort of Western period piece that gets a rewatch every so often. And then I think one of the last times I did it before the pod was in 2015, I think it was, when I went to see it at the Royal Festival Hall for one of the festivals there, with a live score with Johnny Greenwood. Ooh. Which was just like, you know, for a film like this, you know, you've got the first like opening 15 minutes sort of silent, but for this score, so for a live score accompaniment, it was truly the best way of seeing it. And then yeah, I hadn't seen it since then, before the pod.
Amazing. This was my first time watching this film, actually. Mm. Which feels like I shouldn't admit that, because it's so highly regarded, and everyone's always talking about it and like as one of their favorites and all of those things. But it was just one that I just had never got around to see. There's a lot of like very highly regarded films that I just have not got around to watching.
Yeah.
And I tend to shy away from admitting that whenever people talk about it, because I just know they're going to look at me and be like, Jess, you're an actor and you love films and you haven't seen that film. And I don't want to have that discussion.
I mean, the pressure gets too much sometimes. You're like, well, now I'm not going to watch it despite you. I'll get to it when I damn well please, all right?
Exactly. So yeah, this was the first time I had seen this film. And it was also, like, I knew nothing about it. I knew literally nothing. I knew Daniel Day-Lewis was in it and Paul Dano mm-hmm. was in it. And that was about it. I didn't know what it was about. I knew that it was set in this kind of, like, Western kind of America vibe. But that was yeah. about as far as my knowledge went.
Did you know about, say, like the I drink your milkshake moment? Because this is a point we brought up on our episode about it, where it's like, I think even those who maybe haven't seen it, maybe at least through cultural osmosis, kind of know about certain moments from it without knowing it. And the milkshake part is maybe one, or has even that kind of passed you by?
That passed me by. The bit I did know, because annoyingly I'm addicted to TikTok, and there's the one scene with Daniel Day-Lewis that goes around where everyone's like, this is real acting, and it's him being like, I abandoned my child. Yes. And so I knew that without realizing that was from this film. Mm. And then when he started talking, I was like, even before that scene popped up, I was like,
that's the voice
Daniel Day-Lewis, I see you. That was what they were talking about. So that was all I knew about it. But I don't even know why I hadn't seen this or didn't know anything about it. Don't know why. It just happened that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, what I love about this is it's essentially like a story of two like immovable objects of characters. It's a great, I love kind of stories about greed and about corruption of the soul, as it were. And you've got these two very centralized characters who just play off each other so well in such a darkly dramatic fashion, and also in a sort of almost comically cartoonish way. Like the way Daniel Plainview, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, and Eli Sunday, one of two roles from Paul Dano in here, who also plays his twin brother early on, you know, the way they kind of bicker and fight and clash throughout, especially in the moments where it becomes physical, can get really kind of like slapstick in this really sort of darkly funny way as well. And I just love this kind of whole story of Day-Lewis being so set on ambition and greed to the detriment of any kind of personal relationships, and Eli basically kind of being like full of shit and a real slimy sort of coward, and how these two mess up each other's lives over the course of like 30 years almost. And I think that's a brilliant kind of structure to hang around, you know, this big time spanning story.
Yeah, there's something that's quite, there's almost an element of theatricality to it. It's quite melodramatic while still being very naturalistic in the way it's presented, which sounds weird and like a juxtaposition itself, but it is like that might be with, I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis has that element to his acting anyway, where it's quite like big and bold while still being very inward. It's very strange that he's been able to kind of like create that ability. And then Paul Dano is the perfect match for that, I personally think. They bounce off each other really well. But it is, because it spans so long of a time period, it feels very epic while still being quite centralized to this story of just these two men.
Yeah, and you've got this amazing, you know, the amazing cinematography by Robert Elswit. And they were shooting in the same area as No Country for Old Men at the same time. Because in my head, I always thought, was it Roger Deakins who shot this? But no, he was doing No Country, I believe, at the same time in the same state. And it's amazing. Like, I was just reminded recently that Paul Dano was 22 when he did this, which seems insane.
That's
especially
insane.
When you kind of see, when you see some of the other roles he was doing around this. Because just beforehand, he's been one of the best friends in The Girl Next Door, raunchy rom-com from 2004. And as we'll see later, you know, Weapons around the same time. And what's one of the really interesting things we found out about Dano is he's one of those guys, obviously, who's been in so much stuff that a lot of people know and remember, but they can find it hard to remember him. And it's interesting to see him have Little Miss Sunshine just the year before this, and then this, like two really great movies sort of back to back. And then he kind of disappears into smaller indie stuff for the next 5-6 years, when really you would expect a performance like this and a film like this to really propel him into his big break. But what we see is him doing quite a few really interesting indie movies to various degrees of success, Weapons included, where it's like he's making some really interesting choices. He's obviously working with artists that he respects and can get something out of. And whether that was like an intentional shunning of sort of the limelight, or just wishing to do those sort of projects is something we'd love to kind of talk to him about. But, you know, he's famously, you know, never been Oscar nominated for anything, and this could have been, like, this should have definitely been a sort of best supporting turn here for him.
I was surprised when I saw that he hadn't been nominated, especially because obviously Daniel Day-Lewis was, and he won it for this, didn't he?
He did. I think Dano's won. He was BAFTA nommed, but even that remains his only BAFTA nomination, so it's crazy. So
just,
you know,
it really is baffling because Paul Dano does such a fantastic job here. One of the notes I wrote down when I was watching it is that this film is an acting masterclass. Like, if you want to watch something and see really fucking good acting, you watch this film. And it's one of those things because I am not a method actor. I do not agree.
You're not staying in character. You're not being that oil man for the whole shoot. No.
It's not for me. But whenever I watch Daniel Day-Lewis, I'm like, I have to put my hatred for method acting to one side here because he's nailing it every time.
He just really transforms and you know, from film to film, and just seeing him in Phantom Thread as well, the other film he did with Paul Thomas Anderson, and how different a part that is. Like, Daniel Plainview is just so lived in, and it's interesting because it really is kind of a two-man show, this film. Like, there are other great supporting turns from like Kieran Hines and Kevin J. O'Connor, who was Benny in The Mummy, we may remember. And like, those guys are great, and obviously the young actor playing HW as well. But essentially, it's the Day-Lewis Dano showdown for like 2.5 hours, eventually. And I mean, there's very few scenes that Day-Lewis isn't in himself. And I think I just gave a listen back to our episode on There'll Be Blood earlier today, and I think we mistakenly point out, like, oh, the scene that he's not really in is the big church exorcism moment where Dano kind of, you know, get out of here, ghost, to the old lady. But Plainview is in that. You know, he walks into the church and kind of hides just to the side, and his like left shoulder is in frame for a lot of that. And then it obviously the scene ends on his reaction to it. But I'd completely forgotten that he does step in and essentially watch all that. So his presence is 100% all over this. And he's incredibly committed.
Yeah. And like, Paul Dano just like, something about him as an actor, and I mean this in the the nicest way possible. Paul, if you ever find this podcast for whatever reason, please know I'm not hating, but he is very unsettling.
Yeah.
He has,
I'm sure we've said worse.
He has a very unsettling, like, presence on screen. And I think that's why the roles that he's done and the roles that I know him for, he's like nails it every time. Like he knows his casting, or at least his agent does, and they have honed in on that. But he has this very unsettling nature on screen that really worked well with these two characters, because from the off I was like, I don't trust you. You give me weird vibes.
He's so fascinating. Like, what other ones of his have you seen that you kind of recall him in?
I mean, Prisoners. Mm-hmm. That's pretty blatant, like, creepiness. I'll be honest, like, I'm not particularly well versed in his career, which is bad of me, because he is brilliant, like, that's undeniable. But I've seen him in I saw him in like Prisoners, 12 Years a Slave, and then obviously recently in The Batman, where he is very unsettling in that one. And that's sort of what I know him for. And I didn't even realize he was in Okja, which I when I was doing it, I was like,
it's because he's suddenly a bit suave and cool and that, and you're like, that's not like you.
So I need to go back and watch that and be like, but he's just an actor that, what you said earlier is so true. He's one of those ones where I know who he is, and I've seen him in probably plenty more stuff, and just haven't really registered that.
Yeah, for like nearly 20 years now.
And I also thought he was much younger than he actually is. Youthful face. But I was
like, incredibly baby faced, yeah.
I went onto his Wikipedia, because that's where I do my research, clearly. And I was like, oh, he's 38.
Yeah.
And I just fully thought he was in his 20s.
Where, like, he'll fully be for many, many more years. Mentally, I mean,
the best thing for an actor is to look young. Like, you keep playing those young parts.
I mean, yeah, this is where we're so fascinated with the guy, because he's sort of like a young man's character actor in a way. Like, there's not enough kind of A-list character actors who are always great in everything they show up on, but never normally kind of take the limelight that much. And it's interesting, his kind of styles, like, if you were just to kind of sum them up, really, you do have his sinister, creepy side. You know, he's played a young Ethan Hawke serial killer in Taking Lives, and obviously in Prisoners he's really creepy, and in The Batman, of course. And then he's got his kind of outlandishness. So there's a lot of the Riddler in that, and in this role of going really loud with things. And that's why we often think, like, it's funny he hasn't got more awards notice for the times when he goes loud, because that seems to be what, you know, attracts a lot of nominations for things. But then the moments where he goes inwards, he can still be really creepy. Like in Ruby Sparks, he's really sinister, like disarmingly so. And then in places like, you've got like Meek's Cutoff, the Kelly Reichardt film, and his little brief turn in Looper. So there's a lot of like different shades to it, and it seems to either be a lot of either one or the other, or the other. And it's interesting to see him now kind of spread out. And like you say, with him being so young, it's weird knowing he's playing essentially Spielberg's dad in The Fablemans, because in our heads we're like, you're not a dad, but he is a dad in real life.
And it's just like what you said about, like, he goes really big in this film is so true. Like that scene in the church that you mentioned earlier, it's this big, like, very over-the-top speech, which was obviously very fitting. I say over-the-top, but that is fitting for what it is.
Yeah.
And it's like, I couldn't take my eyes off of the screen at that point, because it was so captivating, like, the way that he just kind of, like, completely embodied this man trying to convince these people that he is performing these miracles or whatever.
Yeah.
And really, like, it's that showmanship that kind of sometimes does accompany those sorts of people in real life, the sort of slightly over the top religious men who are like, I'm gonna save you. It's that showmanship, it's that bringing these people in. He's creating a congregation of people who want to follow him, so it makes perfect sense that he's gonna be very outlandish. And then that balances so well with those quieter scenes.
Yeah.
Where he's really like, and that's where it's the unsettling part came in for me, because the switch is so defined. Like, you're just like, oh my gosh. Like, he goes from being big, outlandish. One of my favorite scenes actually is where he says nothing, where he had originally asked if he could bless the rig, the oil rig. And then obviously that doesn't happen. Oh, also spoiler alert if anyone hasn't seen this film. Sorry. And then he just stands there with this very like plastered on little smile that's like, he completely shows how pissed off he is without saying a word. And I was like, ooh, I love me a bit of silent acting.
Yeah, like, it's great. And these are two manipulators, you know, getting to that essence of the two characters again. You know, he's got a lot of the sort of snake oil salesman con man about him when it comes to being this kind of preacher who's out to just manipulate people to his own means. He's just a bit of an idiot with it. Whereas Plainview is sort of a bit more upfront with things, and it's not like he's a con man exactly, but he kind of is. He's just barreling through with business and capitalism at the sort of almost the birth of it all. And he's able to, he knows exactly what he needs to do to get what he wants, as he proves many times, whether it's, you know, going to that other family to get the, to find out about the land early on, or to, you know, forcibly give himself that baptism through Eli to get access to the pipeline and stuff. And it's like those moments, this is where I think Day-Lewis really shines, when he's having to like just eat shit and do something that he's like, I know I need to do this one thing to get what I want, so I'll do it. But it means that, oh, look, it's Eli getting to do this and make a real song and dance out of baptizing me and making me, yeah, shriek about my abandoning my child.
And it's just like, they're such interesting characters to bounce off of each other, because they are quite similar in their, like you said, they're a bit con man-y-esque. And I think that similarity, but it's like their morals are slightly different. Their what they want is completely different, but the way they're going about it is almost exactly the same. It's like, I will tread on all these people to get to the point where I want to be.
Totally.
And I think that's a interesting dynamic for two characters to have, because it's like they both rub each other up the wrong way, because it's, I would imagine in that moment they probably see themselves reflected back on them, and they're like, don't really like that.
We maybe could have been friends in another life.
Maybe.
Very strange friends.
Maybe not ended up in a bowling alley with getting bludgeoned to death.
It's such an amazing end as well. Like I love those kind of moments where it's somebody who knows that they know the truth about a thing, and they get to eke that out to somebody that they fucking hate. And he's just like really, really laying it on, really like getting the payback once again and making Eli denounce God just to be like, nah, I've already drained those lands. And seeing his kind of, his just descent into sort of madness, you know, by the end, they're just two insane people essentially.
Yeah, that scene was so like captivating. Again, like, it was just like you're watching this whole thing play out, and I almost felt like I couldn't breathe, because I was just like, what's gonna happen next? But it was just, again, there's something quite powerful in the fact that it's at the beginning of that scene, it's still very quiet, it's very like reserved, and then it breaks out into this, him literally chasing him around this bowling alley with trying to kill him. But it's so well done, and so, again, so well acted. Like, Paul Dano having to basically be like you said, kind of in his moment, at that moment, eat shit and be like, okay, this is what I've got to do. And then it ends up being completely worthless.
Like, seeing him go from sort of pretending everything's kind of fine, like, there's so much little intricacies happening on his face in his quiet moments. Same with Day-Lewis as well. And it reaching that crescendo. And it's really astounding, because, you know, he was only originally cast as Paul Sunday, the first twin, in the one scene thing. And then the actor originally cast as Eli had to drop out. So he kind of came on as Eli. They decided to make them twins. And he had something like 2 days to prep before coming
on.
Yeah. So it's like,
I did not know that. You know,
what would be his, you know, his biggest role in the biggest kind of acting movie. It's just like, just get on with it. And I think there's been a really good recent GQ article with him where I think he touches on this quite briefly, saying like it was great in that he didn't have time to overthink things. He just kind of got on with it and learned the lines as best he could and then went into it. But it must be intimidating going up against Day-Lewis. But this was actually already their second collaboration as well, because he was in a film called The Ballad of Jack and Rose a couple of years prior, in which they both star, and they do get into a bit of a tussle in that as well. And Dana kind of comes out the semi-victor for a little while in one of the clashes anyway. So this was a lot of payback, I think. But I mean, it's a shame Day-Lewis says he's retired, because I'd love to see the two of them reunite for a third go around on something.
With Paul only having like a couple of days to prepare.
Yeah.
And especially because Daniel Day-Lewis, as we've just said, is known for being very well prepared for a role. I imagine that was beyond intimidating to walk onto that set and be like, okay, here we go. Because it is kind of, there is something about being like a bit more, I don't want to say underprepared. You should always be prepared for whatever job you're doing. But I think there is something to be said for not being too overly like researched. I think sometimes, depending on the type of actor a person is, it can be beneficial to kind of go into something with a bit more looseness to it,
having the element of freshness, like find it in the take. We haven't really rehearsed much. I'm just finding it, like running on adrenaline a bit. That must be what he was doing.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. It depends on the project, it depends on the people you're working with, it depends on who you are as a person. But most actors that I know and most actors that I've heard of like to have a certain amount of preparation under their belt. So to just go in and be like, I've basically just learned the lines, that's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I got to think about how much just being like, say, in costume and on the set, on location, kind of does to, you know, clue you in on it. Like, I think it was so Woody Harrelson or somebody who said, or maybe I think there's a few people who have said, like, for them it's the hair, you know, the wig. Maybe it was Nicolas Cage actually who was saying, like, you know, once I know the character's hair, what's going on there, I feel like I'm embody it enough. Like, have you found that where it's been like getting into the costume of a certain thing and being like, well, now this is helping immensely, as opposed to I guess there's a difference of like heading into like a table read unprepared is different from heading straight but in front of camera.
Yeah, I think sometimes it depends on the, I remember I did, when I was at university, I did my final show, I played this like witch that kind of lived in the forest. And the costume they'd got us was like this big, massive coat that had all of these different fabric pieces on it. It was huge, it was really heavy. And once that went on, it did change a lot of the performance. It does change things. So I can imagine that that would have helped him in that process. I'd be interested to know what his first scene was that he
shot. I was just thinking, like, I don't know whether he shot his stuff as Paul first. I think he might have done. I think it might have been like he did Paul and then was like, that's me done, and then they were like, no, get back here. Because how was he as Paul for you? Because you know, it's an interesting character in that I found twins on screen can often be people play them either very similar or very different. And here it's a bit of both, where it's like, it's clearly his brother, obviously, but there's just something like behind the eyes, like, again, coming back to that minimalism of the acting is so subdued and internal, it can be hard to recognize as being great sometimes. And that's what's quite frustrating when people put in these really great internal performances where it can look like they're not really doing much when really they are. And I feel Paul comes across in his one little short scene as you can just tell that he's this smart guy. He doesn't get, you know, played by playing view straight away. He stands his ground. He does all these things that Eli doesn't really or doesn't do right. And, you know, and his actions kind of are the catalyst for kicking off the whole events of the film and putting Daniel and Eli on the path together. Like, you know, we try and picture Paul Sunday just happy as Larry throughout the rest of time after that, making money. Perhaps he's telling more oil people to go to the same place and just soaking up the cash and running away to the bank laughing. Meanwhile, you know, putting his brother on this collision course with Daniel, which will eventually result in his death.
Yeah, I mean, there was a really interesting little scene, and obviously he doesn't appear as Paul again, but it's just like, it was very, yeah, like you say, there's the undercurrent for that scene was really interesting. It was just like, he's not getting played, but he had this element to him where he, and this again, I think is so, like, it shows just how good of an actor Paul Dano is, because when you first see him, he almost seems like a bit of an idiot. Mm-hmm. And you think, oh, he's about to get, like, rinsed. Like, he's going to get played by Daniel. And then he doesn't. And it's like, oh, so you're the one who's been fooled as the audience member, thinking that he's this idiot that he's actually not. And then as you get to the end of the film and you discover that, you know, that twin has gone off and made lots of money and lived his best life. Like, oh, he was the smart one. Absolutely every single person in this film, he was the one who went in, saw his opportunity, took his money and left.
Yeah,
and didn't get involved in any of this, you know, macho man bullshit. Didn't try and become
didn't
like
sell
this
his
big
soul or yeah, become the worst version of himself. Just did it great. Yeah, there's so many little moments of character interaction that you kind of pick up every time you watch it again, and you know, there's the moment right after Daniel's been baptized where it's the wide shot and you see him shake hands with Eli and say something to him, and you don't know what it is, but if you keep watching Daniel's face, he plays it really interestingly. Like, could that have been like a threat to his life? Could it have just been like a genuine thanks? Like, it could be anything really. And then in the final scene, of course, Daniel is saying, like, I told you I would eat you. And I'm thinking, like, oh, I wonder if that was that moment. Like, the moment he got baptized, he kind of, like, stuck a smile on, shook his hand, but was saying, like, I'm going to fucking bury you. Just you wait.
The dynamic between the two of them is so brilliant. And I think is the absolute, like, center of this film, and why it works as well as it does. It's a slow burn type film, which I don't think is for everybody. There'll be a lot of people who maybe feel like it's a bit of a slog at times because it is quite slow, particularly at the beginning. I found that it felt like a very slow start.
It's kind of unapologetic about that. It's just like, we're going to open with like 15 minutes of silence. You're going to watch this guy just, you know, dig for silver and gold.
But I found that really interesting. Most films, they're filled to the brim with dialogue. So to have like 15 minutes of just not much talking, practically no talking, maybe a few grunts here and there, it was fascinating to watch.
Yeah, having that confidence to let moments sit as well. Like, it's not just a case of like, oh, we're just not having dialogue to a certain point. It's like having just shots play out lengthily and having the confidence and the pull to be able to do that and start your film that way. Like, you know, I always remember the bit when, I think it's right before the first lines come in, when he's essentially adopted HW as a baby, and it's just that shot of them sitting on the train together and him just kind of staring at the baby, and it's clearly just like, let the baby react to you straight for like 30, 45 seconds and play along with that. And it's just these nice little moments. I think it's definitely my favorite of Paul Thomas Anderson's films. I think it's just, it's got so much in it that I really love and admire, you know, and from the story to the pacing, to the performances, of course. And it's like, you know, up there with Punch Drunk Love is a favorite of mine as well. And Boogie Nights as well. I mean, it's insane. He was like 20 something making Boogie Nights. It's insane. So yeah, he's just such a fascinating filmmaker, and Licorice Pizza's been an interesting sort of divisive one. Like, I dug it a fair amount, but like, yeah, this still definitely holds the crown for me.
So the next film we're going to be talking about came out in the same year, 2007, and it is Weapons. It has 4.8 stars on IMDb. It was written and directed by Adam Bala. I want to say Luff. I might be wrong. Stars Paul Dano, obviously, Nick Cannon and Mark Webber. It's a very strange cast.
Yeah, what a trio.
So I watched this film for the first time today because I'm clearly super prepared. I watched it this
morning. You're just pulling a Dano. You're just coming in day before, boom, day off, boom. Yeah.
Obviously, you've seen this film before. because of your podcast. I was listening to your episode about it today, actually, briefly. When did you first see it? Had you seen it before you did your podcast, or was it just you watched it because of your podcast?
Yeah, no, this is definitely a because of a podcast one. Like, I can't think of anyone who's probably even heard of this, let alone checked it out recreationally. You know, like, I've no idea if it really had a proper UK release outside of the DVD. And, you know, as I was mentioning, like, this post There'll Be Blood period is so strange because he's in a lot of these sort of underground sort of films. So there's this, there's Explicit Ills, the year after which Mark Webber directs, which is this kind of just gritty sort of drama about this Philadelphia suburb and the various characters that sort of populate it. And then Light and the Sufferer, which you mentioned at the start, which is so bizarre. It's basically like a student film. It looks like it's shot on just someone's DV tape, guerrilla filmmaking. But it's about these two guys running around New York trying to like get out of town because of drug deals and stuff. But also there's a CG alien panther.
Amazing.
And it's meant to be like it's this sort of alien being that follows you around, and it's this weird, it's like it's too ambitious for the budget in a way, but saying that, the CG isn't that bad, but it just looks like it's been plonked into somebody's home video. Like it's insane. And I genuinely think that was one that was shot about 3 or 4 years previous, and I've got the feeling a few of these were like Weapons for sure as well. I've got a feeling maybe was shot at least a year or two before it gets released. And I don't know how many of these are sort of cashing in on this post Little Miss Sunshine, There'll Be Blood era for Dano. But this feels like one where, you know, so obviously Mark Webber co-stars in this, who he then brings on to Explicit Ills a bit later. But it's this kind of period of him really, of Dano really experimenting with indie film essentially. And, you know, for anyone, I think for anyone who has that idea of Dano as this kind of sniveling guy, always being locked up and beaten or being a serial killer, like something like this shows the all too rare bad boy Dano side, which we've been tracking through doing his films. The Ballad of Jack and Rose I mentioned earlier, which was the previous one of Day-Lewis, he's kind of a bit of a bad boy in that as well. And here, you know, we see him as this kind of like this really sort of crude, like hoodlum kind of like street guy. And really convincingly so, I think. And he really does feel like that character as opposed to somebody acting in this type of film. And that's such a testament to him. And it's so interesting that this and There'll Be Blood are the two that we're talking about. And they're both from around the same time, released in the same year. Because I can't think of two other films that have such a great sort of yin and yang presentation of what he can do.
Yeah. I certainly think that in terms of the rest of the cast, he was the one that I believed the most in this. That is not to shit on the other actors, because I think, you know the saying, you can't polish a turd. I was like, you only
there's
got
certain, there's certain limitations, isn't there? Yeah. This was made for 500K. Like, that's a nothing sort of budget. And it's interesting that, like, the opening scene, which is really attention grabbing with Nick Cannon getting the back of his head blown off by a shotgun wielding Paul Dano, and the very end scene that kind of bookends that, they were both shot on 35mm. The rest of the film's all shot on 16mm film, but all the sort of handycam stuff that Paul Dano's character, what's his name, Chris, shoots and that we see, that was all, you know, shot by Dano himself. So it's very kind of street level filmmaking in an interesting way, and it does look great actually. I think for something shot on film, it really does kind of pop.
Yeah, it was kind of like I was watching it and I was like a bit taken aback because it is very, it's like shaky cam to 100 and then hard zooms that they kept doing, which was very weird to see, because I did research into the director, and he then went on to do a lot of like documentaries, and it had that element to it where it almost looked like documentary footage. It reminded me of, like, have you ever seen the TV show Catfish?
Yes.
It reminded me of that when they're like filming to the side and then they just like hard zoom into someone's face. That's what it kind of like felt like. So it didn't surprise me when I saw that the director had gone on to do documentaries, because that made sense.
It's like kind of amping up, like amping up drama in a scene by a quick crash zoom. I mean, I think a lot of the style of this is extremely mid-noughties. Like, I think the further we get away from the noughties of the decade, the more we can see it stylistically in film for kind of what it is. And there's definitely, you know, a lot of this kind of stuff, especially on TV as well, like a lot of sort of the grittier TV shows of the time have this kind of look and style because it was just cheaper to kind of shoot and block and get done. And I think there's obviously, you know, a whole cavalcade of sort of indie films around this time getting done for hardly any money. You know, this did go to Sundance 2007, nominated for the Grand Jury Prize as well. But I think it's one of those tricky films where it's like, I think this is where on our show we had kind of a tricky time sort of not discussing it, but like rating it in a way, because it's like it's very successful in kind of what the story it tells and the world it depicts. But by its very nature, you know, that is what it is. And so there's a lot of unlikable sort of characters. There's this non-linear structure to the story. So, you know, it's essentially all just about a guy gets killed at the start. We flash back to sort of discover why and then move in and out of that. So we realize, oh, it's for this. And then we flash back again and we realize the kicking off point for this part. And so it's one of those stories where if you laid it out sequentially, it's just like, okay, that's nothing really. But at the same time, the chapter structure doesn't really actually add all that much because it is quite simple, I think. I think it would make a really good short.
Yeah.
And saying that, you know, this is only 82 minutes long as it is, but you do start to notice just sort of prolonged shots of people just driving around and walking around. And again, as a weird counterpoint to There Will Be Blood's very conscious long takes and time it takes in its filmmaking, this is kind of the other end of the scale, I think, where it's just like it's a bit of padding, it's a bit of trying to live in that world, but it's not really saying anything. I think the characters it presents us with, we kind of get them straight away until there's certain plot elements that get revealed that maybe make you think differently about certain things.
Yeah, the pacing was off, I found. Like you said, it was like padded out moments that didn't need to be there. I agree with you that I think this would have worked better as a short. Because there was a lot of dragging things out. I mean, even that opening scene, the way we stay on that burger for such a long time. I was like, someone pick up the burger, please. it was sort of like I felt it drag a little bit because there was just a lot of moments of kind of nothingness.
It is just kind of insane docu-style, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was because it is almost, I mean, they have the elements and the moments where there is literally the home video element, but it is shot like that for the whole film. This kind of idea, it almost looks as if someone's gone in there and they've just got out their camera and they're just filming their friends, which I imagine was probably a conscious choice, stylistic choice. Especially coupling that with the fact that Paul Dano does shoot some of his own things on a camcorder. But it's, as much as it probably was a stylistic choice, there were moments where it didn't quite hit the way I think it was intended to.
Yeah, that kind of opening scene, it's just, you know, Mark Webber just hanging out at home, and then their buddy Jason comes along and they kind of hang out, and then Paul Dano's Chris arrives, and there's that moment where they're just kind of all just sat on the couch, and it's that very much kind of, we are depicting a time and a place and a certain type of friendship group and people here, and it's all done very well, because I imagine this kind of is what like a lot of these guys are like, but without that kind of real narrative drive. And it feels like the chapter structure's mostly here because you can essentially boil it down into scenes that you can count on one hand, you know. And it is strange because after that opening kind of scene, you know, Mark Webber disappears until right towards the end, and it is just kind of finding out the answer to a question that each subsequent chapter raises, and that's the kind of through line through. But it all gets a bit sort of misery, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's just sort of like I felt. So I was watching certain bits and it was like they had all these sort of side characters that I just felt like didn't really need to be there, didn't add much to the story, didn't have a lot to work with as actors either, because there were scenes where I was like, the acting is not giving. It's not good. And that I was like, don't really think that's the fault of the actor in this moment. It's that they're not got a lot to work with. I felt that with a lot of the female characters in this, other than the sister who obviously had Sabrina, who obviously had a bit more going on with her character. The rest of the female characters were kind of just there for window dressing. It was just a lot of moments of like with these other characters that I thought, if you just cut that out and then gave more space for these other characters to kind of have more growth or exploration, then maybe the film would have felt a bit different. It just felt like there were times where I was kind of watching it, I thought this feels somewhat overambitious in what it was trying to do versus what it actually ended up doing, if that makes sense.
It's that weird zone where it's like, this either needs to be way shorter or a bit longer. Like, what it's doing in the time that it has is a bit misused in a way. And you do get these weird tonal kind of shifts as well. Like when the guys go and try and get the gun off of, who is it? His uncle, yeah, played by Arliss Howard. Yeah. It's very much kind of like, well, now it's like we're in this guy's acting moment, because he was, apart from Dano, the other kind of known person in this. But it's like, oh, okay, now I'm in this scene, and this is what this bit is and stuff. And so it's a real tough one. Like, it's I don't blame anyone who hasn't seen it, because there's some of these are really, really tough to find.
I mean, it does a really good job at capturing like a particular moment in time. Like, I was like looking at it going, this is very early 2000s, you know, with the flip phones. I was like, oh my God, a flip phone. Who remembers them? And like all of these kind of like elements to it that were very of the time. It did a good job, I think, at showing that kind of slightly middle America kind of town full of very bored young people who just involve themselves in bad things because they've got nothing else to do. It did well at having that tone, definitely was there, but it was just padded out with all these moments that I was like, don't need it, didn't need to see that, didn't need to hear that line, just kind of this weird amalgamation of just mess.
Yeah, it's funny, it feels like, you know, films of this sort of ilk, there's a lot of recent ones that have done this kind of stuff really well, where it's like looking at like a certain, like, working class people in certain areas of America that really focus on a certain city or state. You know, you've got stuff like mid-90s as like coming of age film, and the Florida Project as well, and things like that. And it's like, so I think with a better like central story, essentially, you can really make these really powerful. And because, you know, Florida Project as well makes great use of sort of non-actors and things, and I think that can often be the way to go. But here, you know, I don't know what Nick Cannon's doing in this.
That was the most random casting choice I've ever seen in my life. I was like, wait, Nick Cannon? I was like, what's going on here? He just sort of appeared, and I was like, this is an interesting choice. This is an interesting casting choice. Having sort of him be opposite like someone like Paul Dano, it's like chalk and cheese kind of in terms of what they're known for and everything. And sometimes that can work when you have someone who's really not known for doing more these sort of like dramatic-y roles and whatnot, but I don't know, it was just a very strange choice. And then I couldn't quite in all of the scenes where he was like, no, we're gonna go kill him, I was like, I just can't can't get behind this. Like, I can't see you doing this. I couldn't believe it. It wasn't believable to me. I was just like, I don't know what's going on now.
Yeah, I think it's such a fine line between truly depicting sort of realism on screen versus just like student film aesthetics. And it's weird how this feels kind of there with something like Light and the Sufferer, which in a weird way is sort of more ambitious, but through its technological trappings comes off as a lot more amateurish, whereas this is clearly done by a certain type of filmmaker doing his style. And yeah, there are obviously things it kind of does quite well. And I guess it all depends on your stomach for these kind of almost poverty born, very focused stories. Because, you know, it is interesting that it kind of all takes place over a couple of hours, really. Once you kind of, if you think of the linear structure, like from one, like the previous night into the next day. And these kind of very central core events that kind of shock like small towns and communities in a way. But it doesn't. You don't really feel the weight of that because it is so insular in focusing on the wrong stuff in a way, like the mundanity of these guys, rather than, I don't know, any kind of real sort of truth behind it.
Yeah, because there are films that do that vibe very well. This kind of like focusing on, like you said, like working class poverty areas, and particularly in America. Have you ever seen the film Tangerine by Sean Baker?
Yeah, the other Sean Baker film. Yeah, he's great. Red Rocket as well is his other one.
Tangerine, like that. When I was watching this, I had kind of like was reminded of Tangerine. I was like, oh, that the vibe in terms of the aesthetic of it. I was like, I kind of was like, oh, it just reminded me of that, and that's a film that I think does that really well, personally, but. And obviously he's gone on to do very similar things, so it makes sense. But yeah, just sort of this film, Weapons, kind of just missed the mark, and I didn't quite know what vibe they were trying to go for. Were we going for this kind of like battling groups? Were we going more like these people looking at these people's relationship? That there was just a lot going on. There was a lot going on.
Yeah, it's weird. It feels almost like, you know, not to drag his name through the mud, Shakespearean, in the sense of like, it's essentially, yeah, like two sides to this community, and there's a central incident that's happened, and then it's just all these miscommunications. So, you know, you find out that essentially Nick Cannon's character is getting revenge, and the younger guy who does the shooting is getting revenge against Jason for something I think he's done, but really Chris was the one that did it, and then he eventually gets revenge against Nick Cannon for killing Jason. So it's that whole thing of like, oh, you did the thing really, and now you're getting revenge for someone for killing somebody doing the thing that you thought they did. Which feels very almost Romeo and Juliet-y of like, if you just calm down and talk, you'll work out who you need to take down.
It is sort of Shakespearean, Jacobean kind of tragedy, where everyone, well, not everyone, but most people die at the end, and you're like, if you'd have just had a conversation, this wouldn't have happened. It is definitely that. There's a play called The Revenge's Tragedy, which has a very similar vibe to that, where it's like everyone just ends up killing each other over miscommunication. And you're just like, oh my God. It's just sort of like this over the top Jacobean play, and you're just like, oh my God. And it is that kind of vibe. And again, like you sort of bring things up like that, and you think, well, maybe that was what the inspiration was. That was the idea behind this.
And sort of transplanting that to this area of the US.
It just didn't quite work. And it's trying to put your finger on why that doesn't work, because on paper, when you say something like that, something slightly Shakespearean, very tragedy kind of vibes, based in this sort of area, it on paper you'd think that that has every chance to be very successful, but I sort of was watching this film and I was like, I'm just not enjoying this. And I was trying to figure out why, and I just think that it is that kind of, it lacked direction for me in a lot of places. It was like, it would go one way, then we were suddenly in the other. There was a lot of scenes that didn't need to be that. I mean, we mentioned the bit at the beginning where Mark Webber's character is just in his house, and there's just like the random scene where he like is talking to his dad, and I was like, we didn't need to meet his dad. We didn't need to. And it just was kind of there, I think. And it's interesting because obviously earlier when we were talking about There Will Be Blood, I was saying that that's a film that does not spoon feed its audience in any way.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that this one does, in the way that it has those characters so that you're almost reminded, oh, he has a family and this is his friends. And like, it's it. Whereas when you take something like There Will Be Blood, you don't need any of that kind of explanation. You don't need to see it on screen because you just know. Whereas yeah, with this, it felt a bit like, I'm going to show you a section where he talks to his dad so you can see his relationship with his father, and then you will know more about his character. But it doesn't add anything because it doesn't come up ever again.
You kind of definitely know where this one's going a lot more than something like There'll Be Blood, obviously. And it's interesting, like, you know, knowing we were having to cover the worst film as part of this very show, I was like, oh god, I always felt bad that you were having to watch Weapons. But I was like, you know what, I actually rather this than have to, you know, have you sit through Light and the Suffer and some of these other ones. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, I first watched Weapons earlier this year in time for when we covered it for the show, and it's like, so I never in my right mind would I think I'd be seeing this twice in 1 year. But like, seeing it again, it does make me just appreciate Dano himself more, like, mm-hmm. if nothing else, him and this. It's a character that he hasn't really touched upon since. It's not really one of his archetypes. He's playing bad boy, but it doesn't feel like he's putting anything on. It feels as ingrained in this character as Day-Lewis is in Plainview, in a way, which is probably the highest compliment I can give. Mm. And I appreciate him in this film, like, way more than some of the other odd ones from this period. Like, there's a film he does called Gigantic in 2008 with Zooey Deschanel, which is just like a very odd rom-com that just doesn't really work. He basically has a cameo in Ang Lee's Taking Woodstock, which is canonically through us the film in which he's the most okay, because he shows up for 5 minutes at a music festival getting laid and getting stoned. He's fine. But then there's, you know, if I'm looking at this sort of this period again, he does a series of films which are kind of his father figure issue films set in New York. There's like almost like a trilogy here. There's one called The Good Heart, where it's him and Brian Cox, which is good. There's one called The Extra Man from 2010, which is just this, it's him and Kevin Kline, which is just a bit of a misjudged thing. But then there's one called Being Flynn from 2012, which is really good. All based on this memoir by this chap, Nick Flynn, who we managed to interview on the pod, who had this amazing life of being involved in like homelessness and his dad having all these issues with his dad. So in the film, Dano is playing him and Rob De Niro is playing his dad. And that's one that really felt like it went under the radar, that deserves to be seen like way more than any of these other ones actually. And yeah, it gets mentioned on the pod quite a lot, because every now and then we're just like, yeah, Being Flynn is the one that no one knows that people should check out. And then sort of just after that period, you know, he's showing up in Cowboys and Aliens, which is kind of almost the cross-section point between There Will Be Blood and Weapons. it's a Western, but he's playing a shit. and then he's got a very small turn in Looper. And then from 12 Years a Slave and Prisoners onwards, that's when he kind of hits his like one film per year, but every film is like a big deal type run, with Love and Mercy and Swiss Army Man and Okja and the Batman and everything. So yeah, it's, you know, as someone who's been diving into his body of work, this middle section is the most endlessly fascinating, and Weapons kind of sits like almost at the beginning of it, interestingly enough.
I've had this discussion with people before, where sometimes certain actors look very, what I would call, Hollywood, very glamorous, and then when you put them into a role, say like this one, it's difficult to disconnect your knowledge that they're this glamorous person and then watch the film, because you can kind of just see. I think there's even been like a lot of actors have mentioned this in interviews. I think like this idea of like, if you have someone super glamorous on the screen, that you kind of can't disconnect that in your brain. And Paul's a very attractive man. But he has this kind of element to him where he looks, this sounds like an insult and it's not, he looks normal. He looks like a normal guy that you would see about the street. I mean, albeit at times a slightly creepy one in some of these films, but he looks like a regular guy. And I think that plays in his favor, because when you watch these films, you're not there going, oh, this is like there's exactly, just certain actors. Yeah. This is like a big Hollywood person trying to play a working class creep. Like, it wouldn't work.
Whereas I honestly think that's like one of his biggest strengths. It's exactly that. And it's that element of character actor that it feels like we're losing a bit. Like, it feels like so many roles now are cast just young and hot across the board. Mm. Or we're meant to believe objectively hot people are like mousy, or you wouldn't be interested in them and stuff. And it's like, are you kidding me? And and Dano's definitely one who is now in this era where he's able to play more mature roles and fathers, clearly, like in The Fabelmans, but he is still very kind of babyface. He does have a lot of range. And you're right. I think, you know, you see him in something like Okja and he is looking fly. And you see him in his GQ photo shoot and you're like, yeah, you are a suave guy. But like, he can, you know, morph himself into any of these kind of parts. Mm-hmm. And you'd be like, yes, I believe you as this normal person. And I think that's a quality that benefits real actors as opposed to stars in a way. And maybe that's what's made him becoming a big star been such an issue and something that hasn't really happened. Mm-hmm. It's like this interesting idea of, can you become a quote unquote movie star whilst looking like a guy you might see working at a car wash? or just down your local, you know? And it's like that's a benefit to him and then the parts he's gonna be able to get, whereas, you know, every time they try and cast some massive star who's, you know, got the jawline of like a god and abs for days, it's like you can try and ugly them up a bit, but I know who it is.
it's why character actors exist. It's why typecasting exists within the industry, because they sort of, again, it's that spoon feed the audience thing. It's like, this person looks like a businessman, this person looks like a gangster, and we have, if you were to turn around and say, what does a gangster look like, everyone would have a particular image in their head based on the films that they've watched. And so you see all these actors battling against what they look like. I think it is a benefit for Paul Dano that he has this ability to kind of mold and become any kind of character.
This exact kind of part of like how people perceive you, like whether you are going to be too Hollywood or too normal, like this is something we're fascinated by. And, you know, we're starting, as we run out of Dano films, you know, we're starting these mini series about other people, and we're halfway through our first one currently, which is all on Judy Greer, and she's someone who kind of falls into that, where she's got this great memoir called I Don't Know Where You Know Me From. It's all about her life as a co-star, and you know, she'd tell these stories of being like, you know, agents and casting directors would say like, so you're not like, you know, hot enough for this, but also you're not ugly enough for this. And it's like falling into that weird midpoint, which is just like normal person. But even then, it's Judy Greer. Like, she's this gorgeous actress anyway. And it's just like, it's interesting to see what passes as normal half the time, especially when it comes to women actors as opposed to guys as well. It's an interesting kind of double standard in many ways.
But it is interesting with Paul Dano. It's just like, it's got such an eclectic career. I'm really excited to see what happens next, now that he seems to have becoming a bit more into the limelight thanks to the Batman, and how that's kind of brought him forward in people's minds, because he does a fantastic job in that. I'm excited to see where this kind of takes him now.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were on tenterhooks, because when we started this pod at the beginning of 2021, I think it was like he had maybe just been cast, or because they've been shooting the Batman since 2020, I think. So we knew it was coming. We were like, oh, now's a great time to kind of start to delve in and uncover his work. Because by the time the Batman drops, we'll be like 3 or 4 seasons in. We'll have done most of it. And then we're going to witness people paying attention to him again, because suddenly he's exposed to a whole new area of fandom, that of like DC and superhero stuff. And we were like, great, he's going to be booked and so busy after that, because he's going to have the biggest profile ever. And reading that new GQ interview profile, he says he hasn't acted since Rapping the Fablemans. He's just back in family mode, and this is it. Like, he very much isn't a Hollywood star. He just like wants to spend time with Zoe Kazan and raise their kids like normal people. And so Yeah, we, you know, we're rapidly running out of his films to cover, and it's like, mate, sign up for more stuff, do some voice work, do something. So it's basically like he's a voice in this anime series called Pantheon that we need to check out. But after Fablemans, there's like a Netflix film he's already shot called Spaceman that should be out next year. And I think he has now just signed up to something else called Dumb Money, which is about the whole GameStop stock thing that happened. So he's got that coming. But like, yeah, certainly compared to the sort of people that a lot of other podcasters do filmography shows on, like Nicolas Cage, for instance, our good friend Petros runs Caged In. Someone like Cage, you know, he's signing up to like four things a year. So it might be few and far between with Dana now, but at least it's manageable for us. And then whenever there'll be something new coming along, it'll be an event for us again. And yeah, fingers crossed he does direct his second film, because yeah, like I say, Wildlife is top stuff.
Is there anything else from Weapons that you wanted to mention?
No, we've done the classic thing of talking around the film a bit, but yeah. I think we covered it. I mean, you know, unless you listeners out there have seen Weapons and can kind of have your own opinions, otherwise it's something that just kind of either needs to be seen or not really. But it's down there in terms of film quality, but like I say, he's still very good in it.
Mm-hmm. So the question I have to ask at the point of this podcast, which film did you prefer?
Well, it's There Will Be Blood, isn't it? Yes, yeah, definitely.
It's gotta be, isn't it? For me as well, it was There Will Be Blood. Yet again, the better film has won. Do you want to tell the people where they can find you on socials, or obviously you host podcasts? What are you up to?
So I'm across Twitter as Matt Brothers 2. Clearly wasn't quick enough to get Matt Brothers 1, the bastard. So Matt Brothers 2 on Twitter, and there's a whole bunch of pods actually. Yeah, mainly in conjunction with this episode here, I'm on Is Paul Dano Okay? That's me and Daryl and a guest each week, going through Paul Dano's filmography. So we've done four full seasons. By the time this episode drops, we'll probably have finished Greer's, which is our Judy Greer mini season, and we're coming back for one more full Dano season to kind of finish off the bottom of the barrel of what we haven't covered, plus his new stuff that's coming. And then we'll probably do more mini series looking at other character actors, and then cover any new Dano stuff as when it appears. So that's everywhere at Is Paul Dano Okay? Along with Daryl, who I co-host that with, I also do Sudden Double Deep, which is the triple bill title podcast, where we look at three films linked by a word in the title. So an interesting one that we're going to be recording very soon is Leviathan. So we pull words out of a tin, basically. And the idea is, you know, there was an episode on Bride, for example. So we cover the Bride of Frankenstein, Princess Bride, and the third one. We can never remember the third one when we're recalling stuff. But the idea is to try and take films from different genres, different decades, and kind of get a good spread of cinema with it. But yes, we have recently picked out Leviathan from the tin. And believe it or not, there are three films just called Leviathan. There's one from 1989, directed by Cosmos, George P. Cosmatos, director of Cobra, the father of the guy who directed Mandy, whose name I was also saying instead. There's the Russian film from 2014, and there's another one, I think, from 2012. So that's basically a weekly show where we look at a triple bill of movies each time, with a little deeper bonus episode in between each week. And then my OG podcast is Spotlight, which is a Star Trek show from three non-Trekkies. So this was one me and my two good friends, Liam and Paul, who are my two buds who live down in Brighton. We started this show together about 6 years ago, mostly as a way to kind of stay in touch with me being up here in London. And we knew going in, you know, Star Trek is a very oversubscribed subject for podcasts. But we found that most of them are all hosted by like diehard fans, and therefore diehard fans. So we're like, let's take almost a book club approach and see if we can become Trekkies by seeing what this is all about. And so we started with the original 13 movies, and then have since moved on to some of the TV series and interviews and bonuses and all sorts of things. So that's mostly a monthly podcast over at Spotlight Pod. So they're the three, really. Yeah.
busy, busy man.
Too busy.
Something I always like to ask people is there anyone else that you think I should discuss on this podcast?
Ooh. Yeah, no, there's a lot of good people out there. I'm trying to think of ones who have like clear-cut greatness and clear-cut shit on the same list. Somebody like Harrison Ford would be interesting, I think, because his top tier out of the indies and the Star Wars and the Blade Runners, it's, I don't know which of those would peak out at the top, but then at the bottom you're going to have some strange stuff in there as well. So people like that, where it's like they've got some real blockbuster goodness in there, and then something maybe a bit embarrassed or ashamed of towards the bottom as well. Without spoiling any, are there any that you're hoping for?
I really want to discuss the person that actually, when I was thinking about their filmography, actually inspired this whole podcast, was actually Hailee Steinfeld.
Oh, wow.
Which is really random. I was just thinking about a film that I'd seen her in that is really, like, obviously bad, but I kind of enjoyed. And I was like, that's a podcast idea. and it is the bottom of her list. I will leave that for when that episode eventually happens.
Oh, nice. But
that is someone that I would like to discuss because it was kind of their whole inspiration for the entire podcast. Thank you very much, Matt, for joining me today. It's been a really interesting discussion. I hope you had fun. I hope you enjoyed your time here.
Yeah, I've had a great time. Thanks so much for inviting me on. And it's always good to spread the word of Dano. They've got the good gospel. Yes.
Yeah. We are the preacher from...
He should start paying me. Yeah. Exactly. I am Paul. The third revelation.
Paul, are you listening? Come on. This man's doing your marketing. but yes, thank you so much for joining me. I hope everyone who's listening enjoyed, and I will see you next time on Better Than Bad.
Make sure you join me next time on Better Than Bad, where I will be joined by Thomas from the Double Edge Double Bill podcast to discuss Nicolas Cage's highest and lowest rated films. We will be discussing his highest rated film, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and his lowest rated film, Jiu-Jitsu. I wonder which one we'll prefer.